This is Fresh Air. The U.S. ambassador to Kuwait made a speech in Kuwait over the weekend in which he addressed the trials of alleged collaborators now underway there. He called for Kuwaitis to champion justice and fairness in the same way the entire world stood for those principles for Kuwaitis. Most of those standing trial are Palestinians, Iraqis, and Bedouin, people who have lived in Kuwait sometimes for generations, but who are not recognized as citizens. On Saturday, a Bedouin man who had served in the Kuwaiti Air Force was sentenced to death by a martial law court for collaborating with the Iraqis. Ken Roth, deputy director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch, returned last week from a 9-day mission to Kuwait. On the last Fresh Air, we discussed the trials he monitored. Today, in part two of our talk, other reports of human rights abuses. While Roth was in Kuwait, the emir announced that elections would be held in October of 1992, an announcement that disappointed members of the pro-democracy movement.
Most of them had been hoping that early 1992 would be the date chosen, and they continue to press for a revision of the emir's statement in this regard. It's worth noting that at the same time as this late date for elections was announced, the government extended martial law for an additional month, the fourth consecutive month now since liberation. And the reason cited for that was the ongoing lawlessness in Kuwait. What we found was that this lawlessness was not the sort of random private violence that the Kuwaiti government and, in fact, the U.S. Embassy often portrays it as being, but rather that the principal problem in Kuwait today is violence organized by Kuwaiti security forces. And this type of organized torture and, in many instances, killing was not at all addressed during the first 3 months of martial law. The Crown Prince, in announcing the extension of martial law, made a very important acknowledgement in that he noted for the first time the problem of mistreatment in police custody and vowed to prosecute those responsible, even his own son, he mentioned, should that be necessary. That was a very important acknowledgement and a very important pledge. It remains to be seen whether the Kuwaiti government will live up to it. One place where we've urged them to concentrate their attention in the first instance is a series of mass graves that we were able to discover in the Al Riga Cemetery on the southern outskirts of Kuwait City. And there are roughly 20 graves there that are clearly fresh graves, graves that were dug since liberation. When we looked at the registry that the gravediggers kept, the registry noted not only when various bodies were buried, but also the date of death in many instances based on hospital records that had been brought to the cemetery, since all bodies have to arrive at the cemetery via one of the hospital morgues. And by looking at those records, we were able to count 54 unidentified bodies who had died since liberation, in fact, since March 6th, that is to say, a full week after liberation and after the height of the private vengeance, the very emotional violence that took place just after liberation. If the Crown Prince is sincere in his pledge to put an end to this sort of violence, one very important place to begin is with those mass graves at the Al Riga Cemetery. It's as a matter of justice, as a matter of telling those families of the victims what has happened to their loved ones, and as a matter of preventing this sort of violence in the future and preventing the deep emotions in Kuwait from breaking out into some sort of civil war, it is absolutely critical that the Crown Prince carry forth his pledge, get to the bottom of these graves, and prosecute those who are responsible for these killings.
The ruling family of Kuwait has banned all opposition political activity in the country. Do you have any idea what's happening in the opposition behind the scenes now?
The opposition is actually quite active behind the scenes. In fact, just this past Tuesday, the opposition organized its first form of public demonstration. It was very much a demonstration, Kuwaiti style, in that everybody met at a mosque and basically sat around and talked. The opposition, which at this stage ranges on the one hand from Islamic fundamentalists to, on the other hand, secular liberals, is united really only on the question of early elections. They differ on virtually everything else, be it extending the right to vote beyond the so-called first-class Kuwaitis, of whom there are roughly 50,000, to the other 600,000 or so second-class Kuwaitis who do not have the right to vote. They're divided on whether women should vote. And they are not publicly speaking out at all about the violence that is facing particularly the Palestinian community, let alone talking about the problems of the Badoon.
My guest is Ken Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ken Roth is my guest, Deputy Director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch, and he just returned to the United States after spending 9 days in Kuwait. In the 9 days that you were in Kuwait, did you try to go off the beaten track and see what you could investigate and discover on your own?
Well, we were, it's worth stressing, always on our own. We were not accompanied by government officials. We had entered Kuwait with official permission, but we were never, followed as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we're not constrained in any way as to who we could meet, other than fear of simply endangering the people who we would want to encounter. But we very much ventured into particularly the Badoon and the Palestinian community. We had more difficulty trying to enter the small and quite beleaguered Iraqi community in Kuwait at this stage, although I was able to speak with some long-term Iraqi residents of Kuwait. But we were quite able to get into the various non-Kuwaiti communities in Kuwait City. And I think we're able to get a fairly clear picture of the serious problems they are encountering. For example, if one walks into Hawali, one of the principal Palestinian areas, one's immediately struck by the garbage piled all over the street, because while garbage collection has been resumed in many of the Kuwaiti sections of Kuwait City, it has not occurred at all in the in Hawali or the various Palestinian districts. One sees these sorts of lines drawn within Kuwait City wherever you go. If you look at the license plates on the cars, you recognize that the Kuwaiti citizens all now have Kuwaiti license plates, either because they were able to quickly exchange their Iraqi license plates after liberation, or they were able to hide their cars in their villas during occupation and thus never had to take the Iraqi license plate in the first place. In the Palestinian community, many of the people don't dare use the Iraqi license plate at this stage. That can be quite dangerous. But they also have been unable to secure new Kuwaiti license plates. The Palestinians noted to us that they don't live in villas, that they live in apartment complexes, and they had to park their cars on the street. And so most of them did have to take Iraqi license plates during the occupation. Their inability to get new Kuwaiti license plates means that they can't use their car without risking very substantial fines, as well as possible harassment and beatings at the checkpoints if they go out and use their cars. So this is yet another factor that leads many Palestinians to be just sitting at home without any possibility of employment, quickly losing whatever savings they had accumulated, and they are really becoming desperate.
Was there a moment of your trip that you found to be an emotional turning point for you, or something that was more surprising than anything else during your trip?
I was struck by the radical disjunction between the various communities in Kuwait. I, on the one hand, was surprised by the normality that existed within the Kuwaiti society. While many of the stores, particularly in the downtown area, continued to be burned out or standing in rubble, life is going on at a relatively normal level for many Kuwaiti nationals, and that normality struck me. But for that normality to be existing side by side with the quite troubling picture that I saw in places like Hawali, the Palestinian district, and for these communities not even really being able to talk to each other or not being willing to talk to each other, that disjunction was moving to me in an extremely troubling way, particularly since I and the few foreign journalists who were there were often the only link between these communities. The Kuwaitis were simply not extending themselves to, say, the Palestinians, and the Palestinians were much too afraid to extend themselves in the opposite direction. And that distrust and divide in what, in the end, is a tiny little country, some 2 million people before the invasion, is something that was really saddening and is perhaps the greatest long-term casualty of the Iraqi invasion.
You're about to testify before Congress. Can you give us a sense of the message you want to give Congress about what you think the United States' role should be now in the rebuilding of Kuwait?
Well, it is clear that the United States has tremendous influence over the Kuwaiti government. This is one of the few instances when we can really say that the U.S. government has created this foreign government. It has made it possible for the emir to return to the throne. And as a result, the United States has a quite special responsibility to make sure that the government that it has put in power is one that, at the most basic level, is respectful of human rights. So what we would urge the Bush administration to do, as well as those in Congress who can be heard, is to make clear that it is simply unacceptable for the sort of violence now taking place, the sort of extreme discrimination taking place in Kuwait, to continue. The U.S. has been reluctant to speak out on this issue. There have been occasional forays, although, as I understand it, President Bush has still not said the D word, democracy, in his public statements. The Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokeswoman, the other day when asked about the mass graves in the Al Riga Cemetery, tried to say that, oh, they're nothing new. You know, there's really nothing of concern there. Although I'm happy to say that the State Department has made inquiries of me since then, and so it may be that they're beginning to move and appreciate the significance of these graves and of the killings that they represent. But so far, it's almost as if the administration does not want to tarnish the glow of Desert Storm, and that anything that suggests that the government that it put into place in Kuwait is anything less than perfect might somehow come back and cost the administration politically in its efforts to defend the repulsion of the Iraqi invasion. I would hope that those sorts of political considerations can be overcome and that the administration can recognize that it has a legal and moral duty to do something about the violence and discrimination in Kuwait and to speak out forcefully and publicly in an effort to structure a democratic society that is respectful of the most basic human rights.
Ken Roth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ken Roth is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. He testifies before Congress tomorrow. This is Fresh Air.